In bargaining, there are many ways parties can indicate that they don't have any more room to move. One way is through the use of a last, best, and final offer. In this episode of the Perkulator podcast, join co-host Emily Martin of Perk, Amy Spiegel with Pierce County Labor Relations, Scott Cliffthorne with Teamsters Local 117, and Dan Peterson with Public School Employees of Washington, as they discuss what last, best, and final offers are, their implications in the bargaining process, and practical considerations to think of when deciding whether or not to make a last, best, and final offer and how to respond to them. We really appreciate Amy, Scott, and Dan joining us to share their experience and wisdom. Enjoy the episode.
Good afternoon. Hi, Amy. Hi, Scott. Hi, Dan. How are you doing today?
Great. Hello.
Pretty good. Thanks for having us.
So I invited you here to the podcast to talk about last, best, and finals. We had a conversation at the end of February at our negotiation projects monthly Zoom. We talked about last, best, and final then. So if anybody was there, this might sound familiar, but I thought we would do it over with a recording and add it to the podcast. So thanks for coming. Thanks for being there. I thought we had a really great conversation, and I'm really glad we did that. Getting into it today, Amy, why don't you start us out? What's the last, best, and final?
Oh, what is the last, best, and final? Okay, well, it's basically a tool used in negotiations to communicate that a party has reached the end of the road, meaning the end of their authority and the components of what that end of the road offer looks like. They're typically made by an employer, and they're made when there's really nothing left to offer, when a party is communicating all they have to resolve whatever matter is being negotiated. And while it's an option in a demand to bargain or interim bargaining, most often you see it during contract negotiations.
So should a union make a last, best, and final? Why or why not? Scott, what do you think?
Well, I think that one of the things that's true about the term last, best, and final is that there's a legal term of art that's last, best, and final. And there's a sort of colloquial, we don't have any room left to move. And so I think that it's fair game for a union to do something like indicate that a given offer or a given potential deal like wouldn't have the unanimous support of the committee, for example, or that, you know, that if the union was to compromise any further, that it's going to threaten a potential ratification vote. So I think that those are fair things for a union to signal. You know, if I give away more than this, I can promise you it'll go down. But I don't think that a last, best, and final from a union per se really has a specific meaning other than those things. Like in Planet 117, you know, we'll tell employers, if we can get this, this, and this in a deal, that would be a fully recommended settlement offer. And in our local union, that means a unanimous recommendation for a yes vote from the bargaining committee. And we can then say, and you know, we can vote an employer offer, but it's not going to be a fully recommended settlement offer.
So you might be trying to signal something similar, but you might not specifically try to use the specific term or to talk about the specific legal context, especially maybe if you don't want to signal an impasse. I'm guessing if that might be significant too.
Absolutely.
When an employer does it, what are you saying? What are you signifying, Amy, when the employer is giving a last, best, and final?
Well, I don't view a last, best, and final as a signal so much as a megaphone. I mean, if you use that term, it should communicate that you're putting it all on the table. I think as negotiators on either side of the table, your credibility is key. And it's going to belong to you no matter where you go. So I also think last, best, and finals can be overused. They should be your tool of last resort, really just to communicate your last, best, and final when you're actually there, to Scott's point of it having two meanings. And when other communication efforts have failed to make that point clear, it shouldn't be the only way that you're expressing that you're at the end of the road.
Yeah, so it shouldn't be a surprise.
Not at all.
So how could they be interpreted? Dan, what do you think? What might a union think when they hear the last, best, and final is being made?
Sure. So as Scott and Amy have alluded to already, there can be a bit of a delta between how I get the proper definition of a last, best, and final and how they can actually be used. So at my tables, when I've received a last, best, and final from an employer, my usual interpretation is that we've reached the limit of what the employer's agents have been authorized to offer by their proper governing authorities. And that may or may not be the actual responsible limit of what they can actually offer in the negotiation. So at that point, you know, I may have some next steps to proceed with. I can, you know, check the offer against my own research and what that suggests they should be able to put forward against, you know, what their own disclosures, you know, publicly suggest they should be able to put forward, and then have a talk with my team about, you know, what the best strategy would be to proceed, you know, whether we think the employer is really at their limit and we need to talk about preparing our members for what that means, or if we think they can and should be moved further and what strategies that might be adopted to prompt them to further negotiation.
Yeah, it sounds like you're reading it as they're at the end of the parameters, and then you need to think clearly, does that really mean that's the end? I mean, it could, or are there more moves that could be made?
Exactly. I tend to read it, you know, more as the signal, at least in my experience, is how it tends to be used.
So are they useful in bargaining? Scott, what do you think?
I think especially no is the short answer. I don't think they're useful. And, you know, I think that the bottom line is that collective bargaining is functioning at its best, I think, from both a union perspective and an employer perspective, when we are reaching negotiated settlements, where there are wins in there for both sides, no one walks away completely happy. But that whatever the composition, whatever the balance is of those wins and compromises, that it's something that is agreed, that's a deal. And I think that the problem with an LBF, last, best, and final, if I can start using that abbreviation, the problem with an LBF is that we're talking about employers signaling the possibility of imposing. And especially in the public sector, I think that that's not a helpful threat, because I think that many of us have the experience that Dan's talking about, which is that we hear the phrase last, best, and final from a negotiator, and it doesn't mean that it's the employer's last, best, and final offer. It means that it's they've reached the end of the authority that they've been delegated by their respective appointing authority. And that, by definition, not what a last, best, and final is in a lot of our experiences. So I don't know. I don't think it's helpful. I think that it raises the specter of a threat and end of the road, a sort of unilateral declaration of impasse. And I don't think that's helpful to the process.
Yeah. So behind every last, best, and final, the question is, what happens next? You know, is an implementation coming? I've seen a lot of last, best, and finals that have led to negotiated settlement, not a implementation. But I think that specter is there as you're bringing up. I think sometimes as a mediator, I've seen last, best, and finals open up a conversation within a union caucus on, are we there? And sometimes it does help a union caucus realize we're closer to the end than we thought. So as a mediator, sometimes I've seen at least the conversation about last, best, and final as a signal have some value in reaching agreement. But that's different than actually what happens if it is interpreted as a threat. And then I guess there was a time in 08 where I think I saw some last, best, and finals actually get implemented. And it was when we weren't seeing wage increases, but we were seeing more contributions on medical. And they were just, contracts were going backwards. And it was really hard for a union to say, yes, we agree to take these cuts. And so I think in those particular circumstances that led to some implementation, that was the best decision for those dynamics, when normally that's not the best way to reach the end of bargaining. I guess those are some of the contexts that I've seen last, best, and finals, but I don't like to talk about them. I don't like to bring them up. I don't like to talk about implementation. I want to get a deal. So that's where I am with those things. All right. So what happens after a last best and final is made? Dan, what does that look like? I think you gave us a little bit before, but walk us through that a little bit.
Yeah. So, I mean, in some cases, that's going to be in some tables I've had where that's been pretty much it. We've rejected it. We've declared impasse and we went to mediation with PERC. And in some cases, we were able to reach a settlement. Actually, in my experience, you know, we've always been able to reach a settlement. But even if you can't, of course, you've got your in under Washington state law, after a full year, the employer can impose a impose their last, best, and final. That's their right under the law. In other cases, like we've been talking about, it can be the start of a further negotiation. And that's, again, in these instances where it can be where the employer is signaling they're running out of space, really, more than anything else, when that's what they're using the term for, rather than actually, you know, saying, you know, they're completely out of any further room to negotiate. I mean, I've had a number of negotiations where we receive a last, best, and final offer that is significantly short of our bargaining parameters from our membership. We have, if we have a good and frank relationship with the employer, we can get permission to have some further discussion with our membership about that offer and, you know, take that out and see if we can get permission to go beyond what our existing parameters were and continue negotiations on, you know, at least some slightly broader terms, you know, just something that is at least not as ambitious as what our initial, you know, negotiating parameters were. And the employer may be able to continue negotiating on parameters that maybe were more generous than what they were originally willing to offer, and maybe, you know, come to some settlement. But, you know, basically, you know, have that as the signal to maybe have both sides loosen up a little bit further. But that's one possible outcome that you could see with that as well.
So you mentioned that's the law, the implementation after a year. And I just want to put out there that that's 4156 and 4156, yeah. 123 talks about that year. We call it the 123 year inside of PERC. I've heard people outside of PERC call it the PERC year. We call it 123. Not every bargaining unit in PERC's jurisdiction is covered by 4156, and some groups have interest arbitration. Putting out there that we have the most collective bargaining statutes of any state in the country. There are some slight differences.
Of course. That's right. There is some variation there. Right.
But that's our major statute. And so a lot of times we think about 4156 as the context, because it covers so many of our groups. And I guess one other thing I was thinking about, and I don't know if we talked about it during the Zoom, is implementation. What is implementation easy? Is it when an employer decides to implement, is that the end of the story? I don't know if anybody has thoughts on that, but I've seen some ULP filings after an implementation.
So I've ever gotten there, but yeah, I mean, certainly, you know, I've done everything, you know, at my tables, I've done everything in my power to avoid getting there in the first place. Has anyone else got any experience with, you know, seeing that or at least gone to that final step?
Yeah, we, so I've worked on both sides of the table. Most of my career has been spent on the union side of the table. So this was from that time period. There was a particularly, this is kind of to Emily's earlier point, there was a particularly contentious issue. It was an interim bargaining issue. And there was just absolutely no way the union was going to put their name on it in order to ensure credit was given where credit was due. We refused to reach agreement and invited impasse and implementation, frankly, because it was just not something we could agree to. And so been on the receiving end of implementation, but I didn't, there was no basis to challenge it in any way. It was, impasse was reached simply because we couldn't be a party to it. And that happens, I think, I don't know, that's probably the most frequent scenario I've seen. Other than that, I've not been in a situation where find the path forward.
Yeah. And I've never walked that path, but to explore the hypothetical a little bit. I mean, to the extent that there are like technical issues or even issues of principle with implementing an LBF, like let's say it's in the context of like a 08 financial crisis, you're going backwards, there are takeaways, there's layoffs. You know, we've seen plenty of issues about things like interpretation of seniority language, disputes over dovetailing versus endtailing, and who's come into the unit over time. So to the extent that you're filing ULPs or grievances about the implementation of an LBF that are based on like real things for winning for our members, then okay. To the extent that it's throwing up more sand to show that like we're doing something when there's no there. I mean, I hear about stuff like that. I don't think it helps unions look strong and effective.
Well, I think sometimes employers hear about implementation, think it's an easy path. So I always try to stress, when you get to impasse, that means there's no point in continuing. I mean, impasse is used differently in our different statutes. So there's a statute that triggers you use the impasse to say whether or not you get to mediation or not. But in general, when you're talking about implementation and the impasse that's existing there, sometimes employers don't realize that might be an impasse, but impasse might break. There might be a reason to get back together. There might be new topics to talk about. There might be more things that are going on. So it kind of seems like a simpler answer than there can be a lot of complexities to it. That's what I want to just put out there, that it can get complicated and can get confusing. And we do have some case law on that point. So it's a great point to be talking to your legal counsel if you're ever in a situation where you think this is going on or what might happen next. All right. So advice for employers. Do you have any advice for employers, Amy, when it comes to last, best, and finals?
Yeah, I mentioned earlier just other communication efforts, right? And while it's true that a last, best, and final communicates you have no place to move, it is not the only way to do that. And negotiators should be really realistic in sending the right signals to their counterpart kind of all along the way, so that their counterpart can plan and proceed accordingly and have clear expectations for themselves and their team about what's next, what's possible. But consider the relationship. I mean, to your point, Emily, it's not an easy path to go through impasse and implementation. The instance I mentioned, it was easy because it was invited, but that is not the norm. And you're going to be working with your labor partners or your employer partners long after this. And so consider the relationship, really understand the impact of the decision you're making, and don't overuse it. There are so many great tools in the negotiations toolbox that can create a much smoother path to settlement. And that said, last, best, and final does have its technical place in the process and can be used when truly necessary. But again, it's not something you want to overuse or use just to send a signal that you could communicate in other ways, in my opinion.
So what advice do you have for a union receiving a last, best, and final? Scott, do you have any more advice for a union?
Yeah, I mean, there's a few different things that we think work strategically. The first is keep bargaining, right? I mean, again, to the extent that we as labor experience the articulation of an LBF as a unilateral declaration of impasse by the employer, that doesn't mean that we might not still have room to move, or that there's exogenous circumstances that change, like you were just pointing to, that open up new vectors for the bargain. And I guess there's a couple of things to think about there, right? I mean, I think it to the extent that we think that things are changing or that there's some vector of the bargain to explore, the information request is always labor's best friend, especially, and I would say to the extent that a union feels like an LBF is coming, prior to it coming is the best time to be continuing to keep up your information requests and exploring new avenues for where you've got room to move. I think the other piece of the puzzle is within our own membership, right? Sometimes when we start to hear that an employer is getting really close to the end of the line, what's incumbent on us is going back to our constituents, whether that's our member leaders on a bargaining committee or a group of workers within a bargaining unit or the entire bargaining unit, to resurvey or to to re-ask a question or figure out, you know, is there some other way to get at the win we're looking for here, other than what we've sort of narrowed down to in terms of our focus in the context of the bargain? If it's not divisible by money anymore, is it divisible by time? Is it divisible by which component of the bargaining unit it will apply to this time around? Where are the ways in which we can pick this apart to find the deal?
So Dan, do you have any advice for unions receiving it, for employers? What do you wish they knew? Is there any other thoughts you would add to the mix?
Yeah. I would say, I think what's been said so far is all very constructive. I think in terms of what I would take a lot of what Amy said very much to heart in terms of advice to employers, that this is a signal that very much says things that could be said in other ways. And a lot of the times tends to rattle the management and union relationship more than anything else. So if you're looking for ways to signal to the other side of the bargaining table that you're running out of space, there's probably another way to do that. And it tends to be received on the other side of the bargaining table in a less than constructive way. So, yeah, I think I would take that very much, at least as far as from a union negotiator's perspective.
So, final question. What do you wish more people understood about last, best, and final offers? Amy, why don't you go first?
Well, I think I covered a lot of it earlier when I was talking about, you know, don't overuse it. Consider the relationship that is going to far outlast whatever round or issue you're bargaining in that moment. But I guess the other piece of advice I would offer is take a moment to get to know your counterpart and maybe a little bit about their background and experience so that you can gauge where you land on the spectrum between having to signal and just having to outright make a phone call and say it, right? Because I think people with different experience levels in bargaining are going to have, you know, they're going to be prepared at a different level to handle some of the signals that you'll be sending. So just take a moment to know your counterpart.
That's really key. And you mentioned that phone call. That can be a very important tool as well to not have a surprise. So Dan, how about you?
So on the union side of the table, right now it's a tool. It's a tool that's being used probably more than it should be, but it's one that has ways to be worked with. So there's a process to be followed. If it results in impasse, there is a process to work with that, whether that means mediation or whether that requires a response of mobilization or something else. But it's one to work with, and it's not something to freak out about. And so it's something to be responded to. And then on the employer side of things, Amy's absolutely right. It's something that can be overused. And yeah, there's other ways to signal that same signal. That's what I would say.
Final thoughts, Scott. What do you wish more people understood about last, best, and finals?
So Local 117 represents about 17,000 workers in the state. And it's a almost even blend of public sector and private sector employees. In the private sector, the last, best, and final offer happens in a very different playing field where, I mean, we do our best, frankly, never to vote a last, best, and final offer. But if we're voting a company offer that the union's not recommending, the ballot that we typically vote that with is going to ask one of a couple questions alongside and whether or not people say yes or no to the deal. And it's going to make it very clear that a no vote is either a strike authorization vote or a final strike vote. And from in the private sector, that's the balance of an LBF, right? The employer has all this power upon declaration of impasse to implement a deal. And the mirror image of that power and authority by the employer is the union's right to strike if our membership really is looking at the deal. But there's balance to that power by the employer, and that's worker power that we don't have in the public sector in Washington state at this time. And I think that that's what I'd like folks to understand about last, best, and final offers, is that to the extent that we're starting to hear about and see more of them in the public sector, that to me is a sign, and I think it's a signal more broadly that people are saying, well, we can't get a deal, right? There's no deal inside the bargaining box. And if that's true, then it's incumbent on us as unions to start to say, okay, well, how do we need to change the box? Do we need to reapproach these questions about public employees' right to strike to balance this threat of implementing contracts? Is it time to explore legislative changes that make interest arbitration more accessible to more groups of workers outside of public safety, right? Because that at least creates a process where instead of the boss determines at the end of the process what the deal is, there's a neutral third party that evaluates the claims of both sides at the end of the process and makes decisions. So I think that those are the big picture questions that arise in last, best, and finals in the public sector asks.
There's some great points. I think trying to think about how does this fit and then how should it fit is all part of the conversation about last, best, and finals. Thank you so much. Thank you, Scott. Thank you, Amy. Thank you, Dan. Thanks for coming today. Thanks for talking about this really important issue. Thanks for giving us a big picture perspective and the nitty gritty boots on the ground. What happens when you see it at a table? What do you do? What can you expect? What expectations might be happening even if you didn't intend that to happen? And where can you go from that? I think these are all really good thoughts for negotiators to have some thought about before they actually see a last, best, and final or make a last, best, and final, because that's the worst time to try to think through some of the big implications and strategies. Thank you so much for coming today and being part of this conversation and being on our Zoom. And this was fantastic. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
Thanks so much, Emily. Nice to see you, Dan.
Thank you. Good to see you all again.
Thank you. Mm-hmm.